Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Opel and the Opel Commercial Vehicles range. We have your van.
Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
Pakistan's borders enclose a land of great linguistic, religious and cultural diversity, a land of many identities. Well, journalist Declan Walsh considers the present and future of what he calls a perplexing, fascinating country in his book called The Nine Lives of Pakistan, Dispatches from a Divided Nation. And he joins me now from Cairo. And Declan, good morning to you. Thank you very much for joining us, first of all. You start your book with a description of when you were leaving Pakistan and it wasn't because you wanted to leave. Will you tell us about that firstly?
So this was in 2013, 3 days before the election. I had a truck full of policemen came to my house in Islamabad. One man stepped out who was not in uniform, and he handed me a letter saying that my visa had been cancelled on account of what the government called undesirable activities, and I had 72 hours to leave the country. So, you know, initially I thought that I could, because I'd been in Pakistan for quite a while at that point, I thought I'd find a way around this problem, but it quickly became clear that that wasn't going to happen. I continued with the election coverage, but then on the last night, I was picked up by the security forces and held for a period and then driven to the airport.
And you had been in Pakistan between 2004 and 2013.
That's right. Yeah. So it was this really combustible period in Pakistan's history. When I got there, things were fairly quiet. A lot of the Western focus was across the border in Afghanistan, where the war with the Taliban was starting to kick off. But in Pakistan, from about 2007, you had this sudden succession of events, the protests against Pervez Musharraf, the military leader that brought him down, the assassination of Benazir Bhutto, the Taliban insurgency that exploded inside Pakistan, and then, of course, the capture and killing of Osama bin Laden in 2011.
So it was combustible, as you say, but you loved it. You loved the country. Is that fair?
Yeah, I did. It was tremendously challenging time to work there. But for all those same reasons, as a reporter, it was absolutely brilliant. And, you know, it was a place that I had incredible. I found that people were very open and I got around the country a lot. I met an incredible number of people. And after I left, that was what made me think about writing a book, was that I really wanted to find a way to sort of convey the breadth of experience I'd had in the country, not just the stories I'd written about for the newspapers, but also what I'd seen the rest of the time.
And you had a well-established life there at the point when you were asked politely to leave for these undesirable activities. You had to wrap up that life from overseas.
Yeah, so I continued to report on the country for a couple of years from London, and we had numerous meetings with Pakistani authorities in New York and in London, other places, but it eventually became clear that I was not going to find a way back. So, I had to pack up my house by remote control and then move it to Cairo, where I've been based for the last 5 years.
And did you ever discover why they decided that you must leave?
That was something that I explored in the book. I tried to get a straight answer from the government and failed. There were hints that came out in the local press where the government was, there were sort of stories accusing me of various things, including being a CIA spy and things like that, which sort of at the very least indicated, you know, how the security forces had seen me. But later on, I met someone from the Pakistani intelligence services, an ex-spy who was based in Europe. I went to see him, and through that meeting, I got an understanding that at least part of the reason for it was related to the reporting I'd done in this remote part of Pakistan called Balochistan, where the military, the government has been fighting an insurgency for the last 10 or 15 years. And it seems that the trips I made there, which is a particularly sensitive part of the country, seems to have played a factor in their decision to kick me out.
I want to talk to you about the premise of the book, The Nine Lives of Pakistan. How did you choose those nine lives? What was informing your choice? Because it must have been very difficult to narrow it down to nine lives. And how did you get there?
I wanted to find a way to tell the story that would really, you know, bring it alive for people who weren't Pakistan experts. There's been loads of fantastic books written about the country by specialists, and I wanted to find a way to tell it for a general reader. And you know, I sort of came to the conclusion that the biggest lessons that I'd learned about the country were through the lives of some of these people. And in a way, the choices that I made about these nine characters, you know, kind of became a reflection, inadvertently initially, became a reflection of the nine different faces of Pakistan. It's, you know, it's such a complicated country. In the outside world, we see it just in the last number of years, we've mostly seen it through the lens of these dramatic, often violent events. But there are other Pakistans as well. And in a way, these nine people for me sort of represented the nine different Pakistans.
And they include Muhammad Ali Jinnah, the founder of the state. Now, where did his idea of this Muslim homeland in South Asia, where did that originate?
It came from pre-partition India. As independence was nearing in the 1940s, there was this really intense debate in India about what sort of government or how the country would be run once the British had left. And the Muslims of Pakistan, led by Muhammad Ali Jinnah, felt that they would not be able to live in prosperity and in security in what they saw would become a Hindu-dominated state. So that was really the basis for what became known as the Pakistan Movement, and eventually for the partition of the Indian subcontinent. And when I was in Pakistan, so many Pakistanis I knew, you know, saw the figure of Muhammad Ali Jinnah as someone who was very important, and they saw him very sympathetically, but they didn't really really agree with the idea that had underpinned the creation of their own country, this idea that Hindus and Muslims could not live together, or that they wouldn't have been able to survive in India under Hindu rule. But in recent years, with the changes we've seen in India under Narendra Modi, with the rise of right-wing Hindu nationalism and a lot of discrimination against Muslims, some of those people that I knew then have now started to change their ideas about that and thought maybe their country did need to be created.
And Jinnah, we know, died soon after the creation of Pakistan. Had he lived longer, do you think the country would have developed differently?
Well, his death just a year after the creation of the country was definitely a huge blow. Already the idea of Pakistan was very shaky in the beginning, because it was this country that was, like Israel actually, formed on the basis of its religion, which is always a very tricky idea, and in the case of Pakistan had not been fully settled what exactly that would mean. So definitely the death of Jinnah, you know, he was keeping the country on a certain course, and it knocked it off that course. So it's hard not to imagine that things wouldn't have been better if Jinnah hadn't survived. But, you know, some of the basic problems that accompany the creation of the country, I think he really would have struggled to solve as well.
I'm really interested to get a sense from you of what Pakistan is like. I know that's very difficult to describe in a short answer, but I said in the beginning that, you know, it has so much diversity when it comes to language, religion and culture. Do you see it as a coherent entity, or is it?
Yes, I think it is. You know, I think it's a country, of course, that is really troubled and has gone through some really dramatic problems in recent years. But by the same token, I think, you know, if you're a Pakistani, you've got a strong idea of what your country is. The cliche is that the country is united by the army, by Islam, and by cricket. I can tell you, cricket is definitely the common factor for all Pakistanis. The other factors are much more ambiguous and have led to a lot of the problems. But it's also this country of enormous potential. And one of the things that I encountered when I was there, and I tried to get across in the book, is, you know, I met so many impressive people. You know, for all of the dark scenes and the violence, I met a lot of Pakistanis who, you know, were incredibly impressive and sometimes inspiring.
And then let's talk about Bangladesh for a moment. East Pakistan became Bangladesh in 1971. What is the lasting impact of that divide?
Well, you know, the creation of Bangladesh was a trauma for Pakistan, partly because it lost half of its population overnight, effectively. It was a huge humiliation for the Pakistani military. And it was also a blow to really the central idea of Pakistan, which was that it was a homeland for the Muslims of the subcontinent of South Asia. Creation of Bangladesh showed that that was not the case, because Bangladesh is also a Muslim-majority nation. And Bangladesh went off and forged its own path. And so, you know, it was a blow for Pakistan in terms of the integrity of the country. It was also, you know, a real marker in its relationship with India. For Pakistanis, this was yet another sign that India was out to undermine their country. And it informed the thinking of the Pakistani national security apparatus, which in some ways led to a lot of the problems we've seen in recent years.
It's said that the ISI, the Inter-Services Intelligence, dominates the country and acts with impunity. And you say in your book, the angels came to spirit me away. So that's the Urdu slang, isn't it, for the people who work for the Inter-Services Intelligence. Has it taken on an almost mythical quality?
Yeah, it has. You know, in Pakistan, people really fear the ISI. It's, you know, it's more than just an intelligence service. It's the political wing of the military. It's a force that has manipulated elections in the past, which has run jihadi groups that operate inside the country and abroad in places like Afghanistan and India. So, you know, there are a few Pakistanis who don't doubt that the ISI plays a huge role, often in the shadows, in the way that their country is run. But the interesting thing about it, you know, when I kind of got up close with the ISI, both in terms of my own story, but also through work, you realize that, you know, they were very good at some things, but in other respects, it was a bureaucratic institution, much like other parts of the Pakistani government that, you know, could be corrupt, could be bungling. So, you know, like a lot of such institutions, you know, they live partly off their reputation. And the ISI never did anything to dissuade people from the idea that it was very powerful, but sometimes it wasn't.
And the army and the ISI, they chose to back Islamic fundamentalists in Afghanistan. Is that right? Do we know why that decision was taken?
It goes back to India, really. The Pakistani military always feared that India would use Afghanistan to basically encircle Pakistan. India is off the eastern border. Afghanistan is off its western border. And it feared that if India got influence in Afghanistan, that it would effectively encircle the country. So that was what drove Pakistan's policy of supporting jihadi groups, really starting with the Taliban in Afghanistan in the 1990s, and then continuing through the 2000s under Pervez Musharraf, even though Pakistan said that it had turned its back on these Islamist groups. I found a lot of evidence that it was still supporting some of them.
Can we assume then that the ISI were aware that Osama bin Laden was in Pakistan?
You know, that's still an open question. A lot of people have worked on that assumption and have tried to prove that story. But as yet, we have no definitive proof. And I think, you know, one of the greatest proofs of that is that in Washington, in the US, where a lot of such information eventually leaks out, we've never had any proof that they were supporting him. But, you know, it kind of gets to this idea that maybe the ISI or maybe the Pakistani security services aren't an entirely coherent organization. And so it's still possible, of course, that there was some little pocket of it that knew that Osama bin Laden was there and was hiding him.
What can you tell us about life in Pakistan? From what you say in the book, there seems to be a big divide between the middle class, how they live and how they view life, and then the poorer classes who would, it seem, they're much more conservative in their outlook.
Yeah, it cuts across all classes, really. It is a class-ridden society. There are, you know, strong divisions between this sort of small elite at the top that often live quite westernized lifestyles. You have a pious middle class, and then you have poor Pakistanis who can be of all sorts, really. You know, I saw, obviously there are, I met poor people who are very conservative, but I also met you know, poor Pakistanis who were relatively, you know, I would say almost hedonistic in their ways. You know, I've been to religious shrines where people would be smoking marijuana. You know, I've been at religious festivals where there's just a lot of song and dance and sort of gaiety and fun. So, you know, it's hard to predict these things strictly along class lines, but, you know, it's a country that's divided by class, it's divided by region, it's divided by religious belief, because you have both Sunni and Shia Pakistanis, and even within the Sunnis there are different sects, and these different sects have different, sometimes drastically different ideas. So that's part of the tension in the country when you're there, that it's such a diverse place and all these groups with all these different backgrounds are sort of rubbing up against each other, sometimes on TV and sometimes violently.
And despite all of those divisions that you've outlined, you're optimistic for the future of Pakistan.
You know, it's hard to say for sure, but of course, yes. I mean, Pakistan's, you know, demise has been predicted many times over the years. People have written books and articles about it. When I was there, you know, particularly during the Taliban insurgency, there was a lot of news headlines in the West talking about a failing state and so on. And yet, over the years, despite everything that's happened in this country, it has stumbled on, it has found a way. And so there's little to suggest that that won't happen in the future, but it's hard to tell.
Declan, a pleasure talking to you. The book is called The Nine Lives of Pakistan, Dispatches from a Divided Nation by Declan Walsh, published by Bloomsbury UK.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.